Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
Hello, primates! You found Primus Tracks, congratulations! We're at Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter. Primus Tracks Pod, P-O-D, not that band, at gmail.com is the email address. I am Josh, as you well know, and I am joined by the eyes and ears, not of a squirrel, but of a hawk, Frankie.
Hi, Josh.
Not to be outdone. He's got the hands of a really fast-moving animal that has hands. This is the worst introduction I've ever done. No, we need help today. We're talking about Eyes of the Squirrel, and it's got a really interesting drum lick. We reached deep into the guest list, and he's back. Even after spending the night last night at Nine Inch Nails and wearing himself out, he's the drummer extraordinaire of La Special. You've heard him on this program before, and I get to say it now. My pal, Rory Dolan, welcome back to Primus Tracks, buddy.
Hey, Frankie. Hey, Josh. Hey, pals. Good to be here again. Thanks for having me, as always. Pleasure to be here.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I'm glad you were able to crawl out of bed today to do this after enjoying a really loud rock and roll show last night.
Oh, yeah.
It should be pointed out, Josh, that Rory was called out at a VIP by Les Claypool as a potential drummer for Primus.
I don't know if he used those words, but yeah, man, you've been having some live music experiences recently. So you're telling us you went to Nine Inch Nails last night, but just last week you caught one of the Tribute to Kings tour stops on this second leg, and you got to drop in the VIP. So how was that?
It was great. Luke and I went along with a couple other friends, his brother Sean, and then a really good friend and big fan of the podcast, our buddy Ryan Flaherty. I got to shout him out because he loves you guys and listens to all the episodes. Shout out Ryan Flaherty, our boy.
Yeah,
we call him the Yan Man. That was our incessant joke of that night. So shout out the Yan Man. No context. But so we went to the show in Port Chester, and the Capitol Theater is like literally one of my favorite venues. It's in Port Chester, New York. It's only about an hour and a half from where I live. It's only an hour from Luke. So it's a real quick ride out there. Real nice historic place. You know, going back to, I don't know exactly when, but there's some great shows there in the 60s and 70s. We actually got to play there once a long time ago.
Wow.
So it's a great room, great place to see them. And Luke's mom was kind enough, I think, for Luke's birthday, which is back in December, to buy tickets for Luke and I for the VIP as like a birthday Christmas present or whatever.
Yeah, sweet lady.
Yeah, she's sweet. Shout out Alice Beeman, Luke's mom. So, you know, I probably would never spring for this myself, as cool as it was. It's just not something that I would, like, you know, seek out.
Yeah.
But it was really cool. So leading up to it, I was a little nervous, even though we talked less in the podcast, but I was like, I was still just a little nervy. And I had a question worked out. We get into the place. It's Garcia's, which is like a small club that's off the side of the Capitol Theater. So they do a lot of after shows there, pre-shows, stuff like that, and just smaller club shows. But there was probably only 30, 35 people in the Q&A, if I could guess.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, the guys came out, and there's a microphone right in front of the stage or whatever. I kind of, in my head, for some stupid reason, thought they were going to be passing around a wireless mic. I don't know why. But you walked up to this mic and asked your question. And we let a couple people kind of break the ice before we went up with our questions. We don't want to be the first people to ask anything. And Luke actually went before me. He asked something about the general basis of his question was about Tommy the Cat and like which version is Les's favorite version, and then kind of tying into that which bass is his favorite to play it on.
Mm.
So I thought that was a cool, engaging question. Les basically said that he likes playing it on the four string. That's always been like his favorite bass to play it on, essentially the Carl. So, you know, like the bass we hear on Suck on This. And then kind of related to which you guys have known and we've talked about, or, you know, it's been said or written that, you know, he used the six string on Seas of Cheese, the Rainbow, just because it was like a new thing then. It was a big record deal. He kind of thought he needed to go all out for it and like maybe go a little flashier with it. And so that was the gist of that. And he seemed kind of, it was a good question, seemed to react well to it. And then I got up there. I asked him, my question was basically, how did each of them prepare for learning, like their learning process for learning the Farewell to Kings material, both individually and then when they came together as a band? Like, did they have any specific ways they practiced it? Things like that.
Yeah.
And it was cool. you know, Les kind of started off and said that it was just a lot of repetition, a lot of listening to it, which, you know, you could assume. But then I was glad to hear from Herb. Herb kind of spoke up and said that he, because Les kind of gestured to Herb at the end of what he was saying, and he's kind of like, well, it's all Herb. Herb got it all to begin with. And then Herb said that, he's like, I wanted to be really solid with it, so, like, there was no question about any one little detail.
Yeah.
So for 2 months prior to rehearsing as a band, Herb played the record at least once a day, but most of the time twice a day for 2 months straight.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's some dedication. And, you know, he's killing it. Like, you can clearly tell that in order to retain that kind of precision and those crazy compositions, you got to really have it be second nature. You don't want to be thinking too much up there.
Right. And to interject a bit, you know, Les could call Getty. And we know he did. Larry can call Alex, and we know he did.
Yeah.
Tim couldn't call anybody.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, man. So it was cool. And, you know, after that, that was a cool answer to that question. And then, you know, went around a couple more times, and there was more time to the Q&A. So they were like, if anyone has a second question, go ahead. And so I'm like, hey, what the hell? So I asked him about Spaghetti Western, and I was basically just like, was there any kind of rooted inspiration or origin story for Spaghetti Western? Like, I kind of wanted to get inside of Herb's head because I was like, you wrote that drum riff and then the song followed, right? He's like, yeah. And I was like, it's just such a cool beat and it doesn't remind me of anything. Like, it doesn't sound like anything to me. Mm-hmm. Just so uniquely Herb. And I just asked him what the influence for it was. And I kind of didn't expect him to have a very specific answer, but he did. He said he was listening to a lot of this Peter Gabriel record called So, from the early 80s.
Oh.
And there was a track. He
it's
didn't
a classic.
Know that. Yeah. And so I'm semi-familiar with Gabriel, mostly through Primus and knowing that it's a big influence on them. But I don't know that record super well, and Herb didn't know the track, the name of the song specifically, but he basically described it as being, you know, there was a repetitive pattern going in the foot, like a boom boom checkum, boom boom checkum, boom boom checkum, and then he said there was these random tom flourishes like here and there, like boom,
yeah.
And then he said I kind of wanted to do something that had a constant kind of repetitive motif underneath it, and then had this tom pattern that kind of wove in and out of it. So I thought that was just really cool insight on his part that it came specifically from that place. You know,
that's cool.
Yeah, excellent. So how do you get from that point to getting some praise from the old colonel there?
Oh, well, so that was more at the beginning of my first question, because when I got up there, I said, hey, guys, my name is Rory. I play drums in a band called The Special. My bass player was just up here asking you the question about Tommy the Cat. And then I said, Les, you and I were actually on the Primus Tracks podcast together with Adam Gates and Soya. And then I kind of looked, and then to that, Les said, he said, oh, you're the drummer dude. And then he looks at Herb and he goes, hey, Herb, this guy can play. So that made me blush pretty hard. And I was kind of like, okay, what do I say now? And so then I turned it on him. I was like, hey, Herb. I was like, you know what he did? He asked me to play 777-9311 just right off the bat, you know?
Right.
And Herb says, oh, so what'd you do? Did you play it? I was like, well, I tried to play it. And then Les goes, well, there's only one person I know who can play that right. And someone yelled out, Jayski. I was like, do I just say Jayski? But I'm looking right at Herb. Do I say Jayski,
right,
you know?
Right.
Someone else did it for me, so I didn't have to do that. Yeah, so there, that's the true story. That's what happened.
You've been described as top-notch by Les Claypool to your face, and now he's said to Tim Alexander, this guy can play.
Yeah, it's kind of funny.
You're building some street cred, man.
Something, man. I don't know.
Oh, what a great experience, man.
It was great. Yeah, I would highly recommend it to anybody who can do it and has like an interesting question to ask or has something that's really feel like they want to engage with the guys on. Because you can tell when people ask the more insightful questions, they do react well to them, you know?
I have never chosen to do VIP on my own. I don't know that I ever will. I just like going to the show and taking it in. Frankie, you're a VIP guy, I think.
Yeah, I've done 3 VIPs, 2 for Primus, 1 for Delirium.
How much of the wine did you guzzle when they weren't looking?
Oh, don't let Cheney hear this, but I didn't drink it. I gave it away to someone. I don't drink.
Oh, yeah. So that's perfect. So if you're teetotal, then you just go, here, have another sip.
Yeah.
That's how you make friends with the VIP. Well, I'm glad you're here for this one, Rory, and thank you for that. That was awesome. But you're talking about Tom Flourishes and a drum pattern, and I thought, hey, there kind of is a connection between Spaghetti Western and Squirrel here, because we're going to get into that in a little bit.
Interesting.
With that description. So before we get there, I think we have a little miscellaneous debris. Frankie, you get to go first.
I got debris, Josh. That's right. So I received a message from Ronaldo, who is a fervent listener of the podcast. He's always leaving comments on our posts about each episode. He's
absolutely
a huge fan.
Yeah.
And he asked me about what is going on at Cool House, November 23rd, 2003. It's very strange because we actually discussed this many, many episodes ago, that everything seems to be going well, but then in the middle of Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, Les starts singing without any energy, and he sounds very angry by his tone of voice. But there's no video, and he doesn't say anything at the audience. He doesn't make any comments. So it's a complete mystery if he was upset because of some technical issue or something related to the crowd. But the thing is that after Jerry, I mean, the rest of the show went on all right. So it was just something that was bothering him in that particular moment. I told Ronaldo I have no clue what happened on that show. So if any of our listeners was present at that concert, it would be amazing if you reached out and told us if you remember what happened during Jerry Was a Race Car Driver that made Les so upset.
And that was Cool House 2003, right?
That's right.
All right. If any of your brains are still alive 20 years later after that show, write in primustrackspot@gmail.com. Frankie needs to know. Ronaldo needs to know. And shout out to Ronaldo. He leaves nice messages. He's a good guy. Thanks for that one, Frankie. I actually have a little bit of miscellaneous debris from last week on Tragedies A-Comin', and this is something I had meant to mention, but I neglected to. So I'm going to play the very end of the track. I don't know if a lot of people catch this on the record, but you're going to hear a guest vocal. Did you guys hear the doggy?
Yeah.
I forgot about that. I knew it was there, and I didn't mention it last week. So, uncredited vocal performance by a dog. We don't know the dog's name.
Yeah, I never noticed that.
Yeah, it's kind of buried. It's very low. But it's so funny that Les just decided to leave it in. I don't, you know, maybe it was just that choice, or he didn't care, or didn't hear it. Good on you, doggy. All right, Eyes of the Squirrel. Whew, what is this, track 6 already on Green Noghide Time?
Yeah.
Time does not slow down. My goodness. So, Eyes of the Squirrel, this one checks in at 5.5 minutes, which is really interesting because it's the only song I know that's actually... It's the only song I know that's 3 minutes and 25 seconds long, but it's actually 5 minutes and 32 seconds long. We'll talk about that in a little bit. This one's credited to Claypool and Lane. Credit pattern on Green Noghide is to individuals, as opposed to just music by Primus. 5 minutes, 32 seconds, about 3 minutes and 25 seconds of it is the song that we know, and then the rest of it is something else for the last 2 minutes. But as we do all the time, we make you wait. Let's talk about live history first.
Eyes of the Squirrel was premiered on February 28th, 2011 in Sydney, Australia, as part of what Les called the Guinea Pig Tour. Mm-hmm. So you can actually watch the premiere of this track on YouTube.
Is that the Moshcam? Moshcam show?
Indeed. Cool. That's correct.
Moshcam!
Let's go.
Fantastic show, right?
Big one.
Yeah, I actually watched that today. That's great. Great clip.
Oh, cool. Yeah. It's very dark, but the music is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. We know about Les and stage lighting.
Yeah.
Actually, can I interject? Rory, how do you feel about stage lighting?
I'm with Les. I don't like it too bright. I like kind of dark and moody and vibey and nothing too bright or shiny. I mean, spotlights are cool for certain things, but I'm definitely kind of like, you know, like the vampire up there, like wanting the lights to go down a little further.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not really not a fan of big flashy light shows.
Yeah.
Unless it's Nine Inch Nails, I guess.
Fair enough. Yes, they have their time and place.
The track was played consistently during 2011 and 2012 as part of the back-to-back performances of Green Naugahyde, subsequently becoming less common in 2013, Scars in 2014, and finally a live rarity during 2017 and 2018. There are just a few examples of this song performed during those years, usually at the beginning of very short set lists that they were doing when they were touring with Mastodon. You know, that they would play a few songs and then they would play the Saturating Seven album in its entirety and then a couple more songs. Current live performances of the song are extremely interesting because this is a signature Jane Lane drum track. But we had the opportunity to hear the track performed by Tim Alexander. And Liz said that when Tim plays Jay's parts, he tends to make his own interpretation and adapts the song to his technique. Liz explained that the song's coda was conceived so that they could jam it on stage. So this is one of those instances which I believe are similar to The Last Superpower, aka Rapscallion, where they intentionally created a piece of music in the studio that they knew they were going to use to jam and explore in a live setting. I have a couple of quotes about the song. Les said, "Eyes of the Squirrel is very Pink Floyd, and that was intentional. We go into space during that part. One of my intentions on this record was to go into space on a nightly basis. I wanted to create parts where we could go off on tangents live. I can turn around and play to the screen for 15 minutes. It will be great." And the other quote is, "Eyes of the Squirrel is actually a very strong commentary on visual media, particularly television. It's just that the title has the word squirrel in it, and that tends to throw people. In Primus, there's always something being spoken about via some colorful character. And a lot of times, colorful characters that will distract people who don't scratch the surface."
Nice. Am I making this up, or was there a point where he publicly said it was originally Eyes of the World, but he changed it to Squirrel to make it a little more Primacy?
You're absolutely right.
Okay. I'm glad I didn't make that up.
Interesting enough, someone asked him that at the Q&A the other night.
Oh, nice.
And they asked him why it's called Eyes of the Squirrel, and he said that exactly, because there's a Grateful Dead song called Eyes of the World, and he kind of looked at Lurie, he's like, well, Lurie's a big Deadhead, and he loves Eyes of the World, but I thought I'd make it Eyes of the Squirrel. So that's just what he said the other day, and I never knew that either, so that's new.
So he did it not just for the convenience of Primus-fying it, for lack of a better term, but also not to step on the dead. I suppose that makes sense.
Yeah.
Boy, that he name-checked Pink Floyd kind of makes sense, especially for those last 2 minutes. But I guess I hear it in the first half, too, but we'll definitely get into this track here. Because there is a lot going on, musically, lyrically, soundscape-wise, I suppose. I don't really like that term, but I really do feel like the last 2 minutes they're kind of creating a soundscape in that regard. One more note on live shows. I got to catch this one in 2017 on the tour with Clutch. According to Toasterland, that was the first Squirrel performed in a span of 207 shows. So it had been like 3 years. And then they just kind of busted it out that night in Eugene. And then only a few more times since. So the last performance I've got is 2018 in LA at the Greek. So it's been some time again. One of these days, Frankie.
One of these days.
I can also say, though, that my wife went with me to that show, and she said Squirrel was her favorite song because of the visuals. She got to watch some cute squirrels on the screen for a while. So that perked her up. All right, let's talk about the track. And Rory, you're here with us. I mean, it does start with a bass loop, but I really think the drum groove is what drives this thing. So you got that drum kit there. What are we working with as far as a Jay Lane foundation here?
Yeah, really cool part. I used to think that this is like Jay's version of Spaghetti Western. Like, it really reminds me of Spaghetti Western in that sense, because it's got some of the same components. It's got this tom roll. Let me just play it, and then I'll try to break it down as best I can.
Sure.
So, basically I have this. Thank you. So yeah, you have this tom roll, and then this quick, crispy Jay Lane-esque hi-hat thing, and then followed by the backbeat on the snare. And the trickiest thing for me in this groove is every other time or every third time he does the really intricate hi-hat thing that kind of links up with Les's, like, kind of noodling down the neck.
Right. You
know, like those kind of like double strokes. And on the record, the recorded version, it's very hard to kind of figure out how he's fitting all those notes in there in typical Jay Lane fashion. But that's essentially it. That's essentially the whole groove. That, like, that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, it's much like that 777 part in the sense that it's very hard to articulate those notes exactly how Jay does them.
Right. Because
he just has that Jay Lane crispy hi-hat work.
And so for drum positioning, it looks like you have is that a floor tom underneath that hi-hat just so you can actually get to those two things in the right amount of time?
Exactly, and it's interesting because that's just the way that it makes sense for me to play this groove because I'm much closer to the hi-hat for the left side floor tom, kind of like Grapevine. And the video that I watched today, the Mosh Cam video, Jay actually was playing it on the floor tom to his right. So I'm not sure if that was a backline scenario, and again, you're saying that's the first time they played it. So I would imagine that in subsequent versions he played on his left side floor tom, but I'm not totally sure.
Yeah. It sounds impossible to have to go from the right side floor tom back to the hi-hat if it's on your left.
He was doing it in that Mosh Cam video. It's definitely not ergonomic at all, but yeah. He was doing it. But yeah, this is how I would do it, and I think that's probably how he continued to do it later.
Wow. It sounds great, and the beat, just articulating, like you said, those hi-hat notes is a Jay Lane specialty, and it really does, hearing you play it in isolation, I can hear the bass line going right along with it as far as those hi-hat flourishes.
Totally.
Yeah.
It had to be something that Jay came up with first, I would imagine. The Heat Les had that kind of reverse thing, and Jay played to that, because it could go both ways. I'm really not sure. We'd have to ask Jayski.
If we can find him. I emailed him a while ago about this record. I never heard back, so hopefully we hear from Jayski someday. I know he's a busy guy. That underpins the groove, and then we have this bass line, and as it fades in, it's kind of interesting because you listen to it and you go, oh, it's Les playing around with looping stuff. But it also sounds like he's playing that little groove, but then he reversed it. Of course, being the investigative podcaster I am, I had to clip that little intro and then reverse it. So this is what, so we have the loop that starts the track and it sounds like this. Here we go. And there's kind of a giveaway there on that fast finger plucking part. It does sound like it's reversed because it does sound like that strike's going backwards when he's hitting the string. So here is the reverse version of that, and this is what it sounds like, and I'm guessing this is the original groove, and then he started playing with it. And the weird thing is it almost sounds symmetrical. It's kind of strange. It almost sounds the same backwards and forwards. Bass line, and then he kind of settles in once the drums come in, and Rory, you modeled that nicely, and he settles in with that. And he's kind of doing that thing, and last week Frankie Lewis was reiterating about how Les is phrasing where he gives us a lot on one and two, so we get that really fast finger plucking and all that good stuff, and then he leaves room on the three and four. So it's kind of, we're kind of getting that, I guess, standard Claypool phrasing there and leaving space for, but then there's a lot of space because the bass drops out, the drums drop out, the guitar isn't there yet. And then there's this pregnant pause every single time. And Primus does a lot of stop start. And this one, it's really accentuated by everything dropping out, except I think for a snare hit, and then they're right back into it.
Yeah, definitely. I never really thought about it like that, but it's true. Just the way that phrase comes around, there's that space at the end, and just the backbeat.
So is what Jay's doing pretty standard throughout? Because we do hear he gives himself some space with those pregnant pauses, I suppose, to get some tom rolls in or other fills in. So he's giving himself some space. So as you were checking out the record and also the Mosh Cam video, were you seeing a lot of variation in what he was doing, and are you hearing it as well?
I wouldn't say there's a ton of variation. Okay. He improvises a bit, like with you know, every 4/8 bars when he'll do like some sort of fill. It's not the exact same every time. But yeah, he's generally sticking to that groove pretty solidly. throughout.
Okay. So, and that takes up about the first 3.5 minutes. Then we get to the last 2 minutes, which is what turns a 3.5 minute song into a 5.5 minute song. We get another less loop, and this is where they're going to space, right, Frankie?
That's right.
Okay. So, actually, I want to hear from you, Frankie. What are your thoughts on the going to space part? I'm curious your thoughts on this track so far.
It reminds me a lot of Rapscallion, which is the analogy that I made earlier. I think the tone, the way, the progression of that part, it's very, very reminiscent of Rapscallion. And it actually served the exact same purpose on a live setting. You can see in the Hallucinogenetics DVD how Liz has his back turned to the audience, and he's looking at the visuals while they're playing the Rapscallion trippy part. That's exactly what he said he wanted to do with Eyes of the Squirrel during the 3D tour. So I think it was conceived in the same way. It's something that they wanted to stretch out and see where it would take them musically. What is interesting, though, is that even though it's similar, I think it has a different impact on Squirrel than it does on Rapscallion. With Rapscallion, it sometimes could get overly long, and you were just waiting for the reward of the final verse kicking in when the song came back to its original structure. I never felt that way listening to recordings of Eyes of the Squirrel, because I don't think they stretched it that much. And whereas Curve was doing something more atmospheric, I think Jay is doing something more intricate in this part. So that keeps you very entertained as a listener, particularly when you are listening to the live versions. If we omit the coda and we focus only on the song itself up until that point, I think it's one of the more interesting tracks on Naugahyde, even though it has kind of a repetitive structure. Mm-hmm. And the only differences here and there are some variation in the feels and, you know, some bass parts. We could say that it appears to be simple, but it's actually a very intricate song.
I would agree with your analysis or comparison, at least to Rapscallion, with the major difference being it. You're right. It doesn't wrap around to the A part again or the main groove again. This one just ends after 2 minutes of noise and then it's done. You know, it does resolve, though, on that nice chord at the end. So it sounds pretty cool at the end of this track. But it doesn't come back around. So for some reason, I'm looking at it like when I saw it in 2017, I went, oh, cool, we're going to see Squirrel. It's my first time seeing Squirrel. So I'm enjoying it. And then they get to this part and went, well, let's see how long they drag this one out. And, you know, I wasn't like running to the bathroom and I wasn't going, boo-hoo, this is boring. But it was fun to see what they were creating out of it. But it definitely went on for more than 2 minutes. You know, just looking at the crowd, some people were getting antsy, you know, going like, well, where's the song? So this is one of those tracks that unless you're more really in tune Primus fan, you might not know it if you're the casual fan showing up looking for your Jerry's and Muds and seeing this one and going, what? What's going on here? I can appreciate it, though, for the atmospherics. It is kind of cool that they're just exploring and taking risks and seeing what they can create and giving themselves room. This is something that they didn't do, I think, on previous records, especially pre-Animals. They didn't give themselves that space in these tunes to stretch them out live. They kind of had to create them, but now they're giving us hints on the record where they're going to stretch them out. So that was a great point, Frankie. And I want to turn that to you, Rory. When you guys are composing, are you mostly playing your tunes straight on stage, or are you finding spaces as you compose and record them where you know on stage we can stretch them out?
It all depends. I think more often than not, it might not be designed that way, like when we write the tune, but then as you play it live enough, there like might be a tendency to want to stretch in one section or another. Stretch on an intro, stretch on a bridge section, or there's parts that just kind of take on a new life when you play them live, so they kind of lend themselves to more improvisation. I can't say that we've necessarily written things with specific, you know, improvisational sections in mind, like in place like that. It kind of just happens either naturally or just, you know, through the course of playing a song. And sometimes it'll happen as a result of playing certain songs so much that you need to do something new with it. And you want to try to take it somewhere else after playing, you know, 100 Fruit Wolf dances or whatever. extend this part or kind of play it a little bit differently or whatever. But I really like that idea of them doing that, like, intentionally and leaving themselves that space, because I think it's cool. Even if it is just like a space jam, I think that's a cool idea to kind of leave yourself that space in the middle there.
Yeah, and it also reminds me of the Grateful Dead again, because I remember as a kid, my dad was telling me about the Grateful Dead, because he used to go see them when he was younger. And he said, yeah, you can listen to the records they made, but they sound nothing like that live. Because they, of course, stretch everything out or rearrange tunes or just play them completely differently because they want to or didn't like how it ended up on the record. And I remember that kind of fascinating me as a kid. It's happening in this band now, so I'm getting it firsthand with my favorite band. It's giving me more of a perspective on that that I can appreciate, as opposed to going, they're not playing it like they did on the record. Which is still a complaint of people, and that's fine because some people go in with that expectation, but... The three of us being seasoned Primus goers, we know what we're in for when we get there.
Oh yeah,
and Frankie is always listening. Remember, so if you're gonna stand there and complain, he's gonna mentally catalog that and then tell us about it on the podcast.
Right. That's right.
Sheila's boils are healing nicely. I want to point out a couple bass fills that I really like because there are those spaces for us to explore. I think my favorite one is right at about 1 minute and 32 seconds below the lyric about oil's constant flow through the Gulf of Mexico. Les is kind of playing it straight. He's playing that groove, and then he throws in a little flourish here. That little bit right there. Just that idea. I think he's matching that idea of the oil spill there. Because it does sound like something's happening to his bass. I don't know what, but maybe it's leaking. So that kind of matches up for me. Pre-guitar solo, there's a cool little fill here right around 1 minute and 53 seconds. He's really moving those fingers really fast. So it's not one of those show-off bass lines like a Jerry or a Mudd where you're really showing your athletic chops there. But he's really showing he's got fast fingers here in kind of a low-key way to me.
How can I describe it? We have discussed how sometimes on the recordings, the pachyderm doesn't come across with the same impact as the live settings with different pedals and different effects. But I think on this track in particular, the tone is amazing on the record.
I like it a lot. It's very mid-rangey as the pachyderm was when he first started having those built. But I think it works here for what they've achieved as far as the groove and the atmosphere and that sort of thing. And I want to ask you, Rory, about the drums, because I've commented upon the drums not having, throughout the record, having the greatest sound, and curious about your thoughts.
You know, I listened to the other episodes where you guys were talking about that, and I totally hear what you're saying. There's like a thinness to the drum tone on this record that's like doesn't have this like just not beefy at all. You know, it's weird. Like, I never really listened to this record very much. Like, I don't put it on. And I saw a lot of these shows during that era, and I was really excited about the record when it came out. I don't think I thought about the drum tone as much back then. But upon closer examination, I kind of agree with you guys. You know, it doesn't bother me too much, but I do kind of wish they had gotten a little bit more love. But I'm kind of curious what the gear choice was for this record, and I don't know. I'm kind of curious if it was just some kit that Les had, you know, in his studio already that Jayski kind of just sat down and played. So maybe it wasn't necessarily to Jayski's particular configuration, or like he didn't set up the kit himself. I really don't know. I would kind of like to ask him. But yeah, I hear where you're coming from with the whole drum tone thing. It's not my favorite drum sound on a Primus record. I'm kind of with Luke in the sense that I like the more lumbering, haunted house, pork soda drum tones. You know, there's just more size to the drums. They just feel huge, you know?
Right, yeah, those drums were recorded for Pork Soda. We know it was that ultrasound in this big warehouse type thing, and it sounds like they were recorded in a big old warehouse because they have that resonance to them. In a small room, you can make drums sound huge. I would point to the Highball with the Devil track on the Holy Mackerel. You know, Les is just recording that in that little space, but he got a huge drum sound out of it. You can gussy things up, but I guess I do wonder if they were kind of on a tight deadline because they either were busy touring or busy writing or just realized, we got to get this record out or get it done at least. and they just took care of it.
I'd imagine that was probably the case, but just add it to the list of questions for old Jayski.
There you go. We'll do a VIP with Jayski on our Patreon page, which we don't have. Don't go there. So a couple of guitar things, too, as we move along. This one, I didn't vibe with the solo on Tragedies of Common, and I tried, and it just doesn't resonate with me. But this one I really like because it's I think this groove is kind of tailor-made for some Lurland stuff. And he brings it with a really jagged-sounding tone, and I very much like it. Really love how that solo ends with that effect, the panning. I have no idea all the effects he's got on his guitar there, but I love that panning sound that's kind of swooping through to signal the end of the solo and getting back into the main groove there.
Yeah, I dig that solo a lot, too. That's very cool. Different. Yeah, I
like it. It's really neat. And I caught you air drumming, man.
Yeah, totally. My video's back. I can tell, I can kind of hear the Floyd influence mostly in, I feel like in Lurland. Like it's mostly like a Lur's tone and kind of his approach is kind of Floyd-esque if there's somewhere that where that reference could have come from, you know?
I think that just how dripping it is and it's occupying that space. And I don't listen to a lot of Floyd, you know, I do here and there, but the thing that strikes me about Floyd is how they use sonic space. It does sound like they're actually going to space, and it's this infinite realm. Their sonics were pretty incredible for the time. I mean, they would be incredible now, you know, what they achieved. Yeah. That's what strikes me about Floyd, and I think I hear it with Lur as well, especially in that solo. But even in the main groove, because he's just kind of chunking on some notes off to the side and just kind of making these noises. And then when he gets to hit those three notes, bow, 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 near the end, to me, I used this word I remember when I was emailing with a friend or something about this album. I'm one of those guys where I have to type my thoughts about a new record, new Primus record at least, and then send it off to one of my childhood friends who got me into Primus and go, here's where they are now. Here are my thoughts. And nice. I remember saying, Larry is striking those notes with such disdain. I remember typing that to my friend. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I felt when I first heard this track. Like he's just
I can hear that. Yeah,
it does. It actually holds together. I'm not a big fan of Frankie. You probably noted that voice crack, so don't make fun of me later. But I'm a pretty big fan of this track, especially the first 3.5 minutes. The last 2 minutes, give or take, I don't think it detracts too much because it wraps up in a fair amount of time. And you're right. I think it is pretty intriguing. Rory, I don't know how much you got into that second part where they went to space, but I think I hear Jay rolling on some rims and then on some of those, I think, tuned cymbals that we heard about from Anthony and Gino via email.
That sounds right. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what they were because Herb used to have like those actual, I think they're called crotales, and they're tuned tiny little cymbals that you use in orchestra. And he played those during the Rapscallion section. That's a very similar sound to what we're hearing Jay do there. But yeah, I liked how that dude wrote in with that detailed list of all Jayski's gear last week. I didn't even know half of that shit. I was like, wow, this is great.
And how much time did you spend on Craigslist trying to find those things?
None. I have too much shit already. I have too many drums and nowhere to put them. So no moss for now.
Let us know when you have a sale. We'll put it out there.
Totally will.
You know, I don't have a lot to say about that last part because it's them going to space, and they're going to space. Have fun. Text me when you get home. Make sure you get home safely, right, when you're coming down. So that's sort
it's
of thing.
It's definitely kind of random how they just go into, like, the two-bar ending where Jayski does that crazy fill, and then they're out. And they go back to the theme for a brief second, but not long enough to reestablish really anything. It's a little odd.
It is a little odd, but I really like that fill at the end because it almost sounds... I know Jay knows what he's doing, but because it's off-kilter as far as keeping time or just counting four, it sounds so off-kilter and clumsy, but it isn't. And I think that's part of the genius of Jay Lane.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's a pretty sick fill.
It's coming. That's a nice resolution.
Yeah, I take it back. It's actually a pretty badass ending.
And you get bonus squirrel noises.
Yeah.
I didn't hear any dogs barking that time. But yeah, I do love that fill to bring it back around, and we get that one iteration of the main riff, and it ends on a triad or a seventh or what, but it does kind of end on that nice note there. So let's talk lyrics, shall we? There's a lot to unpack here. Now, Frankie, you're 7, 8 years old, I forget. So you probably weren't around for a lot of these events that Les is referring to, because it's way back, many of them in the aughts.
Let's see what we can recognize.
And Rory, feel free to chime in. I know you're a young buck, too.
Yeah.
What I really like about the lyrics is we have this repetition, the eyes of the squirrel are watching at the start of every stanza, and then that's ahead of an AAB rhyme scheme over all 8 stanzas. So we've got the eyes of the squirrel are watching, and then you've got AAB, Barry swing his bat, piano playing cats, big mouth drunken whores, and it goes on like that with that AAB rhyme scheme. But to me, this is kind of the start of Les's old man. This is what gets me about this one. It's kind of like an old grouch just listing his gripes, pet peeves, things he sees are wrong with the world, which is fine because this is a critique of TV and visual media. It's pretty much just a list of things. So, there's some nice plays on words, though, that we'll get to. So let's talk about all these references. I would say some are dated, some are not. So Barry swinging his bat, that would be Barry Bonds. He was the Major League Baseball home run champ. With an asterisk, if you care about that sort of thing, because he was obviously taking something. But he left the game in like 2007. It's a weird lyrical reference in 2010. It was a big deal when he was mashing home runs left and right. So piano playing cats, I'd have to go keyboard cat, right?
Let's go.
Keyboard cat, the most famous YouTube video of 2009. And then big mouth drunken whores, pick one. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Could be any of the people famous for being famous that we could see on reality TV, right?
I think that's where that's going, yeah. And I would like to open it up to all sexes and genders because, the people that are the attention-craving thing just kills me, and that's I think that's where Les is going with that one. Next stanza, drama that's for free on reality TV. He comes right back to that, and then he says, where's that tuna casserole, which I guess is a drama point in some kind of reality TV show. I don't know what he's watching. But I will say, sadly, reality TV is embedded in our culture, if that's what you could call it. I don't know that it's culture, but I don't think it's going away. Rory, noted 90 Day Fiancé fan, I know.
Oh, absolutely. I have them all on a hard drive every season.
Those tell-alls get salty. Oh, my goodness. All right. Frankie, I don't know if any of those make their way down to Mexico City, but it's a sad display when we see those. But I will say they come on TV every once in a while in my house as we're flipping through the different things. And I got to say, my favorite one, just to watch people being the worst people imaginable, is Married at First Sight Australia. Or as I call it, Australian Marriage Disaster.
Yeah, they should have called it that.
It's my favorite show.
I've never seen that.
Oh, my God. You know, I should say, if you want to see the worst of humanity who aren't committing actual atrocities, it would be these people.
Mm-hmm. Right. So
it's pretty lousy.
So shamefully entertaining, too.
Oh, yeah. Guilty pleasure stuff.
Before you carry on with the list, when you mentioned the piano playing cats, I just remembered that there's also a very popular meme, and I don't know how much it could have influenced or not this song. It's the dramatic chipmunk.
Oh, I remember the dramatic chipmunk, yeah.
Yeah, which is actually a prairie dog.
Yeah.
Mistakenly referred to as a chipmunk or a squirrel, but the meme the video circulated for a long time as dramatic squirrel or the dramatic chipmunk.
Wow, and I'm looking this up.
Precisely, and it's watching you, so...
That's right. It still makes the rounds. I see it every once in a while. Rory's actually looking it up on his phone because he's too young to have seen it.
I want to see this guy. It says, is it this dude? Wait, I'm going to watch it quick, and then I'll show you. Wow. Yeah, let's go.
That's the one.
He's funny, man. So he's a prairie dog?
Yeah.
That's pretty lit. I like that. I've never seen it, though.
Meme culture. It's everywhere. Even Primus tracks. I apologize. We've got the next stanza. As we change our minds at least half a dozen times, are we leaning red or leaning blue? Red and blue, of course, references to the color coding for the two major political parties in the United States when you look at election maps and so on and so forth. I actually take umbrage with this lyric of change our minds at least half a dozen times. Sure, the House of Representatives flips every once in a while. The White House flips every once in a while. But I'm going to throw this out there. Congressional approval ratings, guys, Congress as a whole, has not been above 40% since 2005. But the U.S. House reelection rate since 1964, all over 80%. Congress sucks, but not my guy. What a great attitude to have. That's everybody's attitude. I don't know if we're leaning red or blue or just for the status quo. It bugs the hell out of me. Next stanza, oil's constant flow through the Gulf of Mexico. Anyone for battered shrimp? That would be the Deepwater Horizon disaster of 2010 as a result of some really irresponsible work done by contractors that allowed that blowout to happen. I will say this is one of my favorite lines, the anyone for battered shrimp. I think that's brilliant commentary on that incident because it's wordplay, but it's also all about environmental disaster. So battered shrimp, really great pun there. The next one is interesting. So idiots start to fester when he shot that child molester. Some call him hero, some call him con. I think this is Gary Plushet, who shot his son's kidnapper on live TV in 1984. This is way back. I was unaware of this one. I had to look it up. This Gary guy, his son was kidnapped by his karate teacher and taken to California, I think from Louisiana, if I recall correctly. They found him, rescued the kid. The karate teacher is flown back. The father went incognito to the airport because he somehow found out when this guy was going to arrive at the airport, went incognito, shot him and killed him. He served a suspended sentence. He was found guilty of, I think, manslaughter, served a suspended sentence, but he didn't serve any prison time after the trial. He did a bunch of community service and so on. And this guy died in 2014 at age 68. Bizarre story. Frankie, this one sounds like it's in your wheelhouse. I think you're going to be doing some Googling after this. Man. If you're friends with Frankie on Facebook, you're going to learn a lot about macabre things, but also really cute animals, so it balances out. Okay. Next stanza, another arrogant ass says he's got an N-word pass. What the hell's an N-word pass? Which, what the hell's a blank, is such an old guy phrase, but for this one, I think it holds true because I don't know what it is. But I can tell you that in 2010, John Mayer did a interview with Playboy magazine in which he said some regrettable things about essentially having an N-word pass, which I still don't know what that means, but I have an idea. So he got some flack for that.
Understandably,
for sure. It was quite ignorant for him to say that. Penultimate stanza. Bran and Anjolie expand their family. Who's going to be the next Octomom? Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, I guess famous for adopting kids.
Adopting.
In bulk, I think they were getting them at Costco. And the Octomom, I think her name was Nadia something.
Wasn't she surpassed by someone who had more babies?
Oh, someone eventually had more than 8 babies at the same time?
I think she was surpassed. I recall reading something like that.
I don't know about that, but I'm sure he's referencing this Nadia lady who had octuplets in 2009. And of course, had to monetize it one way or another, mostly because of all the media attention, because it was an unusual thing to happen. And then the final stanza, Obama wave his pecker at the infrastructure wreckers saying, what you going to do about that gun control? And before I even talk about the content, this is my favorite stanza because of the enjambment. He fits a lot of syllables in a small space. So all these other ones, it's like oil's constant flow through the Gulf of Mexico. And it's kind of rhythmic. Rory, I see you smiling at my attempt at a Les Claypool voice. You do it way better. But then,
no, I think it's good. I think it's impressive, actually.
You just got to get up in your nose. Just got to get up in your nose. But for that last one, it's my favorite one to recite because he gives the rhythmic part and then there's the enjambment at the end. So it's Obama wave his pecker at the infrastructure wreckers saying what you got to do about that gun control. It's so fast. It's funny as hell to me. In case you guys didn't know, Barack Obama was president of the United States from 2009 to 2016. That's who that is. And apparently he waved his pecker. I didn't know he did that as president. That's, of course, a metaphor. I don't know who the infrastructure wreckers are, but the gun control thing was a big issue during his presidency. And as I recall, nothing happened. Well, not much of substance. That's what I've got for him. Did I miss anything?
No, I think you covered everything.
Oh, I got 100%. Yes. Before we go, we should listen to some live cuts because we've got a couple different drummers who have performed this one.
What's first, Josh?
Our first live cut is from High Sierra Music Festival 2013.
Oh, okay. Yeah, 2013.
All right. So looks like we are going to sample the bass tone and we're going to get a little bit of Lurland too. Ooh, I love Lurland. Jay was doing some cool stuff there in the background, too. He was really pushing it. I really like that bass tone. I called it fat, but what I should have called it was...
thick.
See? Thank you for filling in the blank. You're absolutely correct. Thick. It did sound nice. And I don't know if that's what the effect is there, but it sounds like a more dialed back envelope filter, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the sound of that one.
Yeah, it sounds
very
nice.
Bass and drum heavy.
You're a little biased, but that's okay, right? Play into them, yeah. Rory. How about a little Lurland, too? That's a nice one.
Yeah.
Good choice, Frankie. That's good Lurland right there.
Yeah, very, very good quality Lurland, I think.
Yeah, I'm into that one. And solid groove underneath. I do like this, the first 3 minutes of this tune, that A part's really cool. Don't mean this pejoratively, but it's kind of a go-nowhere riff. You just kind of have to loop it. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's you can find holes in there. Sometimes a good groove is a good groove, and you don't want to get away from it.
Yeah, totally. And it's a super unique one at that.
Right. It sounds really experimental. Like, it wouldn't be out of place as a John French drum groove or something like that. John French, of course, Captain Beefheart, and a whole bunch of crazy avant record releases, which I've been really getting into his stuff lately and buying a lot of stuff on Discogs.
Nice. I'm only familiar with Trout Mask Replica. That's it.
Well, that'd be where his signature drumming really... came to the fore, yeah.
Yeah.
And he continued it with all these different artists. It's quite impressive, actually. I'll shoot you some names.
Yeah, man.
Is this from that Record Store Day release, Frankie? What's this one from?
This is from the Green Naugahyde 10-inch EP that came out for Black Friday in 2012. This is my favorite live recording of Squirrel. It's absolutely fantastic. Not only for the soundboard quality, of course, but also for the performance itself, which I think is superb. I think it was a really missed opportunity to not release the full show for the anniversary of the album this year.
Right, yeah, we got that reissue of just the record with some different packaging and that sort of thing. Nothing wrong with that.
And
we
just have two songs from the show, and it's a disgrace. It would be amazing to have the entire album live in this quality.
If this one sounds as good as you're advertising, I'll start agitating right alongside you. We'll make some signs and pick it old Rancho Relaxo. Oh, it already sounds good. Oh, boy. Yeah. Those drums sound bigger. In true Les fashion, he's just letting this go. Nice. Get in the car, guys. We're going to go talk him into it.
Yeah, that one was slamming.
I used to, when, and I don't think my ear was tuned when I was younger, but I used to listen, and of course this is the 90s, I was listening to recordings that were on the Bootleg Barn, and I thought, this band sounds horrible live. But, you know, I'm listening to guys recording on little pocket tape recorders that you, you know, used to set on your desk during college lectures, and that sort of thing. So I remember thinking, oh, I prefer my studio recordings. But with, of course, the advances in personal recording technology, as well as these guys recording every soundboard of every show, we've got some really nice live recordings that have yet to be made public. So really hope that happens at some point.
Yeah, some people asked about in the Q&A, like, why they stopped doing the Primus Live thing and whether they had plans to proceed with it in the future. And Les kind of said that he thought it was just, like, too much regurgitation of the same stuff, like, show after show, like, you know, all these different versions of the same thing. Everyone in the room obviously disagreed. We're like, no, it's great, and you should have kept doing it. But they did say that they're planning on doing some official live releases sometime in the near future. So something to look forward to there.
Oh, very good. This same recording, Frankie, you want us to listen to the Trippy Coda.
Please.
Where is this one from, by the way, Frankie? What's the date and what's the venue and city?
It says recorded live at the Ogden Theater in Denver. Awesome. I've been there.
Okay. Ah, the Ogden. Very good.
Yeah, we've played there.
Right on, man.
Yeah.
No wonder it sounds so good. It must be a nice room.
Yeah, it is.
Well, let's trip out on the last part of this tune. That big kick, that must be the one with the suppressed beater on it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was Gino had mentioned that extra kick with the suppressed beater on it. So that one sounds huge. I will say, when I listen to this, I'm impressed, because a lot of bands will put something down on record that they can't replicate live, but with all the goofiness going on, it sounds like the record right there. It's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Sounds very much like it. I just wanted to grab. I have the big bomber beater. You see this thing?
Yeah, that cotton candy you're holding?
This is the beater. It's wow. They call it the big bomber. So it's this hard felt and then plastic on this side. I usually use the hard felt side, right? That's your normal kick drum tone. But then this big bomber, nice and pillowy, nice and soft. So I don't know. I thought you might like to see it.
Yeah, I'd never seen one before as far as I know.
Totally. So
kick. And that's definitely going to change the sound you get. As far as the transfer of kinetic energy into sound energy, yes.
Yeah, buddy.
I've been watching some Bill Nye, Frankie. Don't make fun. Right after Australian Marriage Disaster, I have to cleanse the palate, so I watched some Bill Nye. It restores my brain. That sounded great. I do think we need some more official live releases. These two so far had Jay Lane on drums. It looks like our third one is going to have Jay on drums as well, because we're going back to Australia for Mosh Cam.
Let's check it out.
Frankie's note on the Mosh Cam performance is Jay Lane appreciation. I think we can all get behind that.
Oh, yeah.
Listen to the crowd cheering for Jay. Crispy. You know what's striking me, and I know he does it on the record too, but he just does that little hi-hat, I think with the foot pedal, right? He's just closing the hi-hat after the snare there?
At the end of the phrase?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're hearing his foot. Just kind of, he's basically just keeping time with his left foot, you know?
Yeah, and it's on the record, but I don't really hear it every time. I'm hearing, and I was talking about there's that wide open space of silence, but he's just sneaking in that little hi-hat with the foot pedal there. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, totally.
It's more prevalent there for sure.
Yeah, he seems a little bit more energetic, and he's playing maybe more fills in this version or some of these live versions. It's a little bit more embellishments than on the record, just to my ears.
Well, we know he's a big ball of energy, that Jay Lane, so he brings a lot to the table, and I think that's really cool. You know, comes through in those live performances.
Oh, yeah.
Good choices, Frankie.
Thanks, Josh.
You're quite welcome. Final thoughts on Eyes of the Squirrel, Rory?
You know, as is usually the case when talking to you guys, I have more of an appreciation for the track now after having dissected it a little bit more. I always thought it was a really cool, unique drum part that kind of threw me for a loop. But, you know, the song itself, everything else about the song, never really did too much for me. Mm-hmm. But I think that just by way of like learning the drum part and then learning, kind of looking at it more closely and being like, wow, that's really kind of tricky to play. And how are you going to come up with something like that? Is really intriguing to me and gives me a deeper appreciation for it.
So, and it could be as simple as just repositioning your drums in different places.
For sure. Yeah, so that's definitely part of it. But it's definitely interesting to think about, you know, and even going back to me asking Herb about Spaghetti Western, like, I would want to ask Jay if there was anything stewing for him or any kind of seeds of inspiration for this one, or if it was just off the cuff and it came out of him. It's always interesting to know where these people are coming from when they create these things.
Yeah, those inspirations can be inspiring to us as well without being derivative, which is always a plus.
Totally.
How about you, Frankie? Does this one have a lot of replay value for you?
A lot, particularly in the context of listening to the album in its entirety. I have to be honest, it's not a song I listen to in the spur of the moment. It's more a song that I enjoy in the context of Green Aldehyde. I think of it as one of the big songs on the album, in the sense that it's long, it's got this kind of epic quality to it. So, I mean, we have the singles, we have the favorites, and this I think is in the category of big songs.
And I think for a big song, it's perfectly placed at track 6, kind of right in the middle. So it bridges your A side, B side. So to speak. It works for me. Yeah, it's not one I seek out, but it was cool to get live, and it was a surprise, and I enjoyed it. And I think in the context of the album, it makes sense. And I don't think I would ever skip it. I remember, well, I'd say after a while, at about the 3 minute, 45 second mark, I was pressing skip, but that was years ago. And I think I can enjoy the noise at the end for what it is. Mm-hmm. It's no longer noise. It's going to space. And I think with that, Eyes of the Squirrel, I'm taking the batteries out of the remote because you've been tracked. Next time, Frankie, are you coming home for the holidays?
Frankie's on smack.
I won't be coming back, Josh.
That's a shocking development. Rory, what are you doing next week? I need help.
Oh, well, tomorrow I'm leaving for Illinois. Le Special is playing Summer Camp Music Festival in Chillicothe,
awesome.
Illinois.
That's right.
It's like 2 hours south of Chicago. It's a great festival put on by the band Mo and Umphrey's McGee. And we're actually playing a Primus set Saturday night, 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. And then we're going to be playing an original set on Sunday night at midnight. So,
wow, you guys are getting a lot of stage time.
Yeah, it's a 2-hour Primus set, too, and it's not Frizzle Fry, so we're having fun with playing some of the songs that we haven't done in a while. Like, we got some Pachyderm in there, we've got Beef, we brought back Lacquerhead and Cow. So it's fun to be able to dig into some of the other records and not just play the Frizzle Fry stuff. Obviously, there's 5 or 6 songs from Frizzle Fry, but to do some of the other stuff is fun. So we were practicing last week and this week, kind of brushing the cobwebs off of some of those older tunes. It's fun to play them again, Tommy included, which I have had to run the vocals like every day of the week in the car driving to and from places so I can get it out of my mouth.
It's a tough cadence. You can't sure be mealy-mouthed on that one. You have to enunciate perfectly, and it's tough.
Yeah, it is. It's just repetition, man. You just got to do it 1,000 times.
Well, shoot, have fun at summer camp. I don't know if they do any live streaming, but man, I would love to.
I don't think they do an official stream, but you know, it's not unlike us to maybe throw our phones up and just give you a phone stream. It's better than nothing.
Absolutely.
Or at least document it in one way, shape, or form. So I'll make sure you get at least some snippets to show you guys.
I'm sure Frankie would pay top dollar of my money for a soundboard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rory, of course, LaSpecial at LaSpecial Music on all those socials. LaSpecial.net is the website. You can get all those tour dates. Summer Camp sounds great with the Primus set and the original set. You guys have a lot of stuff going on this summer, too. So, guys, go check out LaSpecial.net. Get those tour dates. Go see them. They are incredible. Les Claypool said, this guy can play. It means something, right?
You're too kind. I appreciate it, buddy. Thank you.
You got it. Thanks again, Rory.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It's always a pleasure. I always enjoy talking with you guys. So, anytime.
Thanks, man. We appreciate it, too. Right back at you. Thanks again, Primates. Later days.
Willie Mays.